Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The premiere of Lovecraft Country is over, but we are just getting started here on post-show recaps. Hello, everybody. This is not Josh Wigler. This is Mike Bloom. Josh Wigler has gone missing. He left this note, but damn, I just can't read it. But hopefully we'll be able to figure this out over the course of the podcast as we talk about the fantastic premiere of Lovecraft Country. Of course, I am not alone. I am merely the driver in this vehicle. This is a three-person party here, and I'm very excited to introduce the two passengers who are not so new voices if you listen to the preview podcast. First, let me welcome back Mr. Kevin Mahadeo. Kevin, how are you?
Hello, Mike. How are you doing? No bites on you today, right? Nothing I should be worried about as we record as the sun sets here.
Yes, I mean, as the father of a one-year-old, I'm covered in bites, but they're mostly of my own child rather than any sort of supernatural creatures, at least I think. And yikes. I'm so happy to welcome this person back to the podcast after her sterling out last time in the preview. But this is her first ever episodic recap, not only on post-show recaps, but in general. LaTanya Starks, welcome back. How you doing?
Hi, I'm great. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
That's right. Happy birthday, Mike.
Happy birthday. Mike, it is your birthday.
It is my birthday.
A declarative statement.
Yeah, exactly. Dwight Schrute said it and everything. And I have the honor of getting to come on and talk about what honestly for me is probably my favorite pilot since Watchmen. And that's not saying much because it's been like 6 months and it's another prestige HBO show. And LaTanya, you made a lot of great comparisons to it. But this is an episode that I personally really loved and can't wait to get all your thoughts on it. That being said, before we get into this, if you have somehow wandered your way into this podcast without knowing a thing about Lovecraft County, don't worry, we're not going to be as mean as Eustace Hunt or anybody else. We'll give you just a nice warning here. This is going to spoil the heck out of the first episode of Lovecraft Country, as well as probably provide a lot of speculation into future episodes. So if you haven't watched it yet, go watch it now. It's about an hour and 10 minutes on HBO and any sort of platform. Go check it out. Come back and listen. That being said, if you haven't listened to the preview podcast, and if you've checked out Lovecraft Country, you will know that this is a show that deals with a lot of visceral themes, a lot of topical subjects, and also a bit of gore as well. So suffice it to say, there will be some touchy subjects that are spoken about. We want to be open and honest about a lot of the themes in this show. So if that's something that you are not necessarily in the right headspace for, totally understandable. Just wanted to give you a full warning ahead of time before we let loose. And also, we're going to be accepting your feedback all season long here. We're making a little guidebook, as it is, of various post-show recap stops to make along the way. So feel free to write in. You can write in longer emails to lovecraft@postshowrecaps.com, or you can tweet to the host. Josh is at Round Howard. Kevin is at Kev Mahadeo. LaTanya is at LK Starks. I'm, of course, at Post Show Recaps. Reach out with any feedback you have. Just getting all the formalities out of the way here because there's just too much stuff to bite into, for lack of a better term, over the course of this pilot. So hopefully everyone who is here has seen this episode. I just want to start by, you know, you, Kevin, LaTanya, you both came in here super pumped, not only about the themes of Lovecraft Country, but also, you know, the work of horror itself. And we can certainly talk about how much horror was involved in this pilot episode. But let's start, Kevin. You know, you walked in, you famously are someone who didn't want to check out a lot of promotional material for it. So give me your thoughts about this episode at first blush.
I mean, I already am so in love with a lot of the things they did. I do think it was an extremely strong pilot. I think that the opening was incredible. A lot of the stuff at the very beginning was great, but then it did hit that, like, I feel like pilot territory, right? Like when they're in Chicago is very much, it's all good, but it is very pilot-y when I was watching it, that like, okay, let's time to set, you know, set the stage, set the era, set the characters. But the moment they got back, you know, they started their trip, and especially the moment they got into Simonsville, I think the show took off in the direction that I anticipated it was going to be going anyway. And it was just nonstop. Like, I think I have in my notes, like, the moment Simonsville entered in the equation, like, they're driving in, my anxiety flew through the roof. And I think, you know, that it just, it, there's so much in this show and so much in here that I wanted that they provided. And like, using Simonsville is actually really interesting, because that is something, not just the anxiety, but like, you have that moment when they're driving to town and Atticus like looks out the window and he sees the people there outside and they give him a look. By all, you know, intents and purposes, from what they read and what has been said about the town, they should be okay. There is a diner. But he just had that gut feeling. He knew, just instinct upon seeing it, like, he could tell, like, something's, this is not right. And that is a feeling, I think, that is so true to people of color, where you can hear all the stuff about how great and how safe and how okay, and there's a spot here and it's good, a place can be. But then you walk in there and your gut will tell you immediately, like, no. And, like, I like, those are the type of things, even, like, those type of things that like, I just really respond well to, because it just feels so seen, I guess is the best word for it. I mean, I talked about it, you know, Latanya and I think we talked about it in the first preview podcast about stuff that we liked in Get Out, is that they hit so many things that like, we just know instinctually and don't have to be over-explained to us as audience members.
Mm. Latanya, what'd you think about it?
Yeah, I already love this show. The Simonsville or Simmonsville...
Simmonsville, sorry. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. The Simmonsville like title card part, I have a lot to say about when we can get there. For me, it wasn't even the people. It was Atticus, Jonathan Majors' character, noticing that dog barking. Mm. I mean, like, racist animals are like a real deal, you know? People training their dogs to go after Black people, to like slave hunters having dogs to chase after Black people is a real thing. So if you meet a person and their dog just starts going wild at you, then that gives you a little bit of an indication about that person. Also just the fact that Atticus notices so much, is so observant about the world around him, you know, and is able to, we're able to see that through his eyes. But yeah, what a stunning, rich, densely packed, well-written, well-acted, phenomenal show. From the very first shot, which opens like a surreal kind of newsreel nightmare that gets even more nightmarish until, you know, the very end where it's just kind of like a WTF moment. I don't know. This show is a meal and I feel like I'm stuffed. I'm just like super excited to talk about it and to cover it more. And people should know, the first episode I saw on Misha Green's Twitter today, in addition to her dropping some like really cool handwritten notes that she took about the pilot, both on her Twitter and Instagram. She also posted a link, that HBO put the first episode up for free for anyone who doesn't have access, to HBO. So you all can, check out her Twitter and, find that there. But just overall, I thought it was just delightful, a great experience from top to bottom. And I'm so excited to get into it.
Something that I really noticed about, I don't know if it's about HBO pilots or just like the quote unquote golden age of television, but I especially saw it here in Lovecraft Country, is, Kevin, I think you do bring up some interesting points about the scene setting of it all. You know, they really did set up this idea of like, I wouldn't call the South Side of Chicago necessarily idyllic at that time, but the idea of like home and the joyousness that's found in community and that block party before, you know, sending them out on the road and into just how dangerous and dispiriting that is. But I would say that the thing that I've really been enjoying about a lot of HBO pilots is Puzz sort of get that notorious reputation of, you know, being so vastly different from the show. But I feel like so many HBO pilots are so, like, actualized. Like, they know exactly what they're going for. They have this story that they want to tell over a series of episodes. And like you said, like, just from the beginning with this very surreal dream that I think maybe might have been people's expectations from jump as to what the show was going to be, which is like, let's combine historical elements with just wackadoo sci-fi elements, only for us to get, you know, rocked out of that dream, like Jackie Robinson swinging a home run. And then we end up getting shocked right into a more of a realistic timeline, to the point where we don't really see any quote-unquote horror or Lovecraftian elements until about 20 minutes until the end. It's such an interesting amount of pacing, but the way that they sort of trickled in these characters and trickled in, you know, it's tough to call this really like a mystery show as of yet, especially compared to something like Watchmen. But I really enjoyed the way that this was all paced out, considering it was completely surprising. Again, I don't know what you both expected the show to be. I definitely expected it to be more of a road trip style, where the ultimate destination would be your Artem/Arkham, and each episode would be a stop along the way. I was stunned when we ended up getting into Artem, you know, in the last 3 minutes of the show, Kevin.
You really, like, it's actually funny, because when I was watching it and I started that road trip, I was like, man, I got some real Supernatural vibes here about, like, just on the road. And, like, part of me thought, like, oh, I wonder if this is sort of like the thing, right? Like, it is a longer journey and they stop at certain parts, and you know, you have like your almost episodic monster that they're dealing with. It just there's something very much like that Supernatural's been on for 15 years at this point, that like,
yeah,
really,
last season's coming up,
yeah, that really leans in, like, has solidified itself as like, if you're driving through middle America and there's horror elements, you might think Supernatural. But yeah, I do want to, like, there's, you know, like LaTanya said, there's so much in here and like you just feel stuffed. But I do want to kind of break down, especially that beginning sequence, that one on the bus, I thought was really interesting. And, you know, just to warn everyone listening, like, there's probably going to be a lot of what's about to happen, which is essentially like conjecture almost and reading into stuff on my own, because it's, you know, they might talk about some of this stuff later. They might confirm or deny. And a lot of this stuff, when you look at texts that are so dense and so rich, you know, people read into things more than was always intended. I think, for example, going to Get Out, as I always do, because I love it so much, people talk about that scene where Ashley Williams is eating cereal but drinking the milk separately, which I rank as one of the most horrific moments in that movie as a person who loves cereal. I was like, what is this?
Yeah,
Allison Williams. Thank you. Yeah, Ashley Williams was someone else entirely, actually. But when Allison Williams did that, it was so horrific and like just unnerving. And a lot of people read it as like separating white from colored, right? Like that is the direct visual representation you're seeing. But Jordan has sort of confirmed, like, that's a great read. Not at all what I originally meant. I'm glad that read came there, but like he just wanted an unnerving scene, and accomplished. So anyway, all that said, leading up to that opening sequence, which was, like you said, is so interesting, where it's this person, like, you know, in the trenches fighting, and then, you know, entering this weird sci-fi realm with War of the Worlds and aliens and all this other stuff. I read that as something really interesting, because I saw this in a subtle way, where you're in the trenches and you're fighting, and all of a sudden you fight your way into this realm of science fiction and fantasy and horror. These are all places that people of color and black people of color were not basically allowed. We didn't show up in these fictions. We didn't show up in these narratives. We literally had to fight to get into these types of stories and to be able to become part of these stories and almost control our own narrative within these stories. This is something that's actually only happening really, really recently. So like, I don't know if that was intended, but like, I saw that as something really fascinating and interesting, because, you know, you look at a lot of these stories of the past, it's always side stereotypes at best. And to have this idea of like literally fighting in the trenches so that you can emerge and join a world that had been established in the middle of everything and kind of become a part of it, I thought was something really, really cool. And that, at least to me, that's, I read into that a little bit much probably, but it definitely spoke to me, because like, as a person who is a person of color, but also is a writer, I really felt that moment. Like there was something there that I think really spoke to that, at least conceit and theme.
Well, yeah, and I think, to your point, I think there is some there. For example, you know, when Tick is walking with this older lady to town, you know, he does say, you know, boys from the south side of Chicago don't become the heroes of these stories. And I think what you're speaking to is a very salient point about how only very recently are we looking at Black individuals as the center of the stories without, you know, adding additional baggage from the fact that, oh, they're the hero because they're Black. It's just... They're there because they're character first. And I think that it's a great statement about not only the show, but to your point, and also concerning the fact that Atticus is a vet, and I'm assuming that we're going to probably hear much more about his experiences, if that woman on the phone is any indication. I can imagine that's a little bit of like PTSD mixed with that wanderlust that also might be applied to his love of science fiction, LaTanya.
Yeah, so... just from a top level perspective, I just start to talk about the opening shot. The thing that I like to keep in mind when having this discussion about this episode are the key themes that jumped out at me when watching, which are the concept of Black superheroes existing in everyday life, just as living life. You almost have to be superheroic at many times. Centering Black love and the structure of the Black family and its importance, grappling with trauma, as you just mentioned, both generational and inherited trauma, that could be race-related PTSD or combat PTSD. Right. Then, you know, there's the uncanny surrealism that Kevin, alluded to when talking about like coming out of a trench in Korea. And then all of a sudden you look up and you see spaceships. And then, you know, like what happens with the, when the monsters are people, and when the people are more scary than the actual monsters. One of the things that I think is really noteworthy about that opening shot, is that, you know, we open like, it's almost seems like a newsreel, old fashioned kind of like footage. It's in black and white. And then Tick, just like, played by the immensely talented Jonathan Majors. I don't know what more superlatives to give to him throughout this podcast. I'm sure I'll figure out some more.
I want a different adjective every podcast
every time
tell you about Jonathan Majors.
I heard that it'll, I'm right on top of that, Rose. I'm sure it'll happen. so yeah, he's like embroiled in the trenches, then emerges. And what you hear though is, the words, "This is the story of a boy and his dream." But more than that, this is the story of an American boy, and the dream is truly American. And that's taken from the 1950 biopic, The Jackie Robinson Story, which obviously comes into play, pun intended, later when we see good old number 42 taking out a giant creature, Cthulhu type creature. So we see like the larger scene, Tick looks around and like sees flying Cthulhus, UFOs in the sky, and there's like this red-skinned alien that emerges from a spaceship and kind of transfixes Tick enough to whisper something from an unknown language and distract him from the giant Cthulhu monster, which is then killed by Jackie Robinson, which is just amazing. Like that imagery right there of, you know, someone who was a Black, like a real life Black superhero to so many Black people and still is, with the, you know, integration of the MLB, in Jackie Robinson, saves you from a monster that is like entered your dreams and then turns around and looks at you and says, "I got you, kid." Like that's every young Black person's like dream is being rescued by someone like Jackie Robinson. And then we wake up and we realize, you know, he wakes up and we realize that that was all a dream. And instead he's sitting on like in a segregated bus, like in the back of a bus. And the only other person there is this like older Black woman who I tried to find the name of this actress so hard and I could not locate it. Because I thought she did such a great job when they're having this conversation walking down the road, discussing, you know, the book that,
John Carter.
Yeah. Do you all have either of you all, is this a real book?
So this is a real book series. You probably more so remember it from a modern day perspective as a terrible film by Andrew Stanton. That's John Carter of Mars. Yeah.
Okay.
So the original book, like I could actually, I'm glad we're delving into this part too, because I could talk a while about this one, and maybe we will. But the book itself is written by Edward Rice Burroughs, who created Tarzan as well. He's a famous pulp author at the time, and he did Princess of Mars, which kicked off the John Carter series. And it's really interesting. I mean, the movie, I've seen John Carter, and it's so weird. On a tangent here, just real quick, but that movie is super odd because it's not a great movie, but a lot of complaints about that movie is that it feels derivative of a lot of things we've seen before. Star Wars and, you know, a lot of space-based adventure stories, Flash Gordon, et cetera, et cetera. Ironically, this is one of those situations where it's just like, no. Those movies are derivative of John Carter. That's actually where it started.
Princess of Mars is like 1912 or something.
I think before that,
so much stuff.
Really?
But like, that's where a lot of these things get established and a lot of these stories. But it's so funny because when you take a book that old and modernize and just redo it and like, not redo it, but like make it now, it feels derivative because we've seen all the stuff that came from it. So it's very odd. But John Carter, The Princess of Mars is definitely real. And it speaks to that pulp era. And Latanya, you were talking about like that conversation. And that conversation I really loved because, one, I there's two parts of it. The whole like you can't put an X in front of that, like where he was a Confederate soldier, which is true. And that is something so accurate about like the idea of like, how do you just erase that sort of history and that sort of past? And like the idea is like you couldn't and you shouldn't. There's characters who are facing that now, and it's so weird to think about how long it took to kind of like circle that square, because you have a famous comic book character, Jonah Hex, who is a Western superhero, well, not superhero, but a Western comic book DC character, who his outfit is a Confederate uniform. Why wouldn't it be? Because he's from the South. And so there's a thing where now they're just like, oh, well, we should have him retire that uniform and like get a different uniform. And of course, the only reason it's happening is because of everything that's going on with Black Lives Matter and everything, you know, the protests is like they're making that sort of superficial change. But like, it's crazy to think about that, right? Like, this is the type of stuff that we have just overlooked, that we kind of like, not we, but American society, let's say, a specific type of people in American society.
Yeah, the PIC.
have just basically been like, no, it's fine. It's fine. Let's just, you know, there were heroes on both sides. It was just like, all right. So I love that they call that out so specifically. But more than that, the book is of the pulp era. I don't know how familiar you guys are with that sort of storytelling and that era of adventure stories.
All right, there's a suitcase with a golden light in it, right? And then there's like, when they hold up the diner, there's like two different versions of it.
Correct. That is the pulp fiction in which I am speaking. No, this is like your Indiana Jones taking place within the 1930s, 1940s, like punchy heroes going around saving the world. And I do like Tick. I love that era. I am super invested in those types of stories, those types of adventure tales. And growing up, like I love that sort of stuff. And even to this day, I actually play a RPG, homebrewed RPG that one of my friends has made, that is a pulp adventure style tabletop role-playing game. And I love it. But the other part of it, of course, is that it necessitates an almost ignoring and accepting of what that era was and what those stories are. And that is tough. It is sometimes hard to just acknowledge and let that go. But like the pulp era, one is just in the writing by the authors is pretty racist because, you know, they were. But also like so much of those stories, if you look at Indiana Jones, if you look at a lot of those things, if you go to Disneyland, Adventureland is homage to that type of era of storytelling. And you'll have to notice that Adventureland has very specific look to it. And that is, you know, an ethnic look because that's what those stories were. It was about like white adventuring heroes going into you know, different areas like the Middle East to India to, you know, Asia, Africa, and seeing it as like, it's adventure and rip roaring fun. And it's weird, you know, to look at it now, but I love that era, but it's hard to also then ignore those parts of it. It's a really tough thing. And I think when Tick spoke of it, it really hit me on a personal level because I felt very much like that. Like that's how, what I constantly think about as a person who loves that era, you know, having to sort of acknowledge the fact that it is steeped in a lot of racist ideologies and symbolism.
Yeah, I mean, Tick says, he follows up to that, you know, you can't put an X in front of that. He follows up by saying stories are like people. Yeah. Loving them doesn't make them perfect. You just try and cherish them, overlook their flaws, which is a very loaded statement considering what we're going to find out about Tick's own feelings about his own family. But that also speaks to, you know, I was really trying to figure out, you guys did a great job of sort of talking about the effect of Lovecraft, but also his problematic, for lack of a better term, history. And it's interesting how they made mention of it. And I feel like two different ways. Because one
is obviously...
We can
say racist. He was racist.
We'll say racist. Absolutely. but I mean, one is when we cut to Tick and Uncle George later in the shop, they mention that poem, which is racist as all get out. But a quote like this, I don't know, maybe I'm like Kevin and I'm looking too much into this, but part of me does feel like it's the show's statement of being like, yes, the man that we're sort of, you know, loosely basing this off of was racist as hell, but we're taking these stories back, we're taking these characters back, and we're using it to tell our story.
Yeah, I agree with that part. I feel like, you know, the spoken word parts of the soundtrack are very important, and their mission statements for this show. We didn't mention this, in the preview pod when we talked about just like the cast part, but I wanted to mention that the music for this show is being composed by Laura Cartman, who did the music for Underground and The Beguiled and Set It Up, and the great Raphael Sadiq, SADIQ. I know him from Tony, first of all, but he's like a Grammy Award-winning musician who has worked on Insecure in the past. And Cartman did like a really interesting interview talking about how this is the first show to use an all online orchestra, but also said that Misha Green wanted a hip hop orchestral gothic feel to the music and the excerpts that they used. And I feel like all of the spoken word that's in here, the quote from the Jackie Robinson story later on, we'll talk about the Baldwin excerpt from that debate, which is so important that starts the road trip. And then, you know, this discussion that they're having as they're walking, because they're, you know, they just acknowledged that they passed over a bridge, and they were like, Atticus, Tick is like giving the finger to the sign of Kentucky as they, and they're acknowledging that they just passed over a bridge that is probably named after like an old slave owner. The bus breaks down that they're on, but only the two black people that were on the bus end up walking the rest of the way to town. And during that conversation, yes, they do kind of set out the mission statement for the show, which is that, you know, yes, there are some messed up things that have happened in the past. We now get the right to call the shots and reappropriate those things because we grew up enjoying them. And saw all of the issues that were, you know, in that text and with the people that wrote them. And now we get to interpret them using our own lived experiences. So future generations have different texts to look to, as formative. I think, you know, that quote does it. And then, you know, I think the outset, opening quote, from the Jackie Robinson story about it being a story of an American boy, like all of that really puts out there what the mission statement that Misha Green and the rest of the creators of this show want, you know, Lovecraft Country to be about.
That idea of like, I think is really important, right? Like the idea of reappropriating these stories to the people with whom they have, I'm trying to think of the right word. It's not sullied, but like the people in which whom have been, you know, victimized essentially by them.
Yeah.
Taking it back and like telling these stories. And I think that's going to be part of the character journey. I'm curious to see how it goes too, right? Like there's a mission statement about like, you love the things that are there and they're not perfect. But there is a debate about like, sure, it's not perfect, but is it right to just ignore it? And I think that becomes the question here about what it becomes. And I think, you know, for me, you know, depending on how I'm looking at it, I can't ignore the stuff that like is steeped in pulp as much as I love it, as much as I can sit there and watch Indiana Jones all day, every day. Like the origins of it are from, you know, the idea of like a white person finding very strange and exotic locations for them to like adventure in and punch stuff. But it is like it's super weird because at the same time, again, like I feel like they're so important and it's defining. And I guess it comes down to that reappropriation part of it. I think to make a weird comparison, one of the most important episodes of television for me personally recently, like probably like one of the most important episodes ever in my life that happened recently is the episode Indians on TV from Master of None. I don't know if I ever spoke on this in any of the podcasts I've done, but that episode, that entire show, I love for various reasons. I mean, one, as I point to my skin color right now, but that episode specifically, Indians on TV, spoke to something that I have been yelling and screaming and fighting about for ages, about how we are portrayed on TV, how we've been portrayed on TV, what has been allowed, what is accepted, the way Hollywood sees us, you know, the idea that like, even if maybe some people, you know, it'll be okay, the whole is not ready for it. That type of stuff is really, really key. And it did something though that I think is super fascinating, because there's a point in that episode where two of the characters are talking and they bring up the movie Short Circuit.
Short Circuit
one and two.
Fisher Stevens, yeah.
Correct. As a kid, here's the thing. I still love Short Circuit one and two. I love those films. As a kid, I didn't know that. And just like that, just like, you know, Aziz, I think at a certain point, just as that character, you know, that he was talking to at a certain point, every, I think, Indian person has that moment, had that exact moment where the glass broke for them, where they were just like, wait a minute, that was a white guy in brownface? And like, it blows your mind because you didn't realize it at the time. And, you know, obviously looking back now, it's terrible, it's odd, it's awful. But at the same time, as a kid, you without knowing, you were just excited that a version of you was on TV and in a movie in some way, shape, or form. And so in a similar way, I think, you know, this is sort of thing Atticus is going through, where the idea of things have, you know, things might be shattered for him during the series. His perception of stuff, the texts he loved, the stories he loves, maybe are going to be shattered, and his view of the world might be shattered. But what do you do with it afterwards? And I think that's a big thing, you know, I think that the story and the series is going to try and address. But yeah.
Is it safe? Is Atticus our audience analog, do you think? And I imagine that, again, like the characters are going to be so multifaceted, especially in our main trio. But I think, you know, what we sort of, at least what I've discerned from Tick up to this point, is that because of his predilection towards science fiction, he is sort of going to become like the expert, like the go-between, right, between the Lovecraftian horrors and the modern day, or his modern day reality, to the point where, you know, he brings up the Shoggoth, I think. Yeah. His name was, and I don't think it's been officially confirmed whether or not those creatures that they end up facing down are Shoggoths. It looks a lot like there's a monster in Monsters, Inc. that had a bunch of eyes and like landed on the jacks. It kind of looked like that, more so than a blob with a million eyes. But he sort of served as like, you know, the one to introduce that to the audience, and to Letty and to Uncle George. So I do wonder, you know, to that point, Kevin, either from a practical perspective or from a thematic perspective, I don't know, Latanya, I don't want to, you know, cast too wide of a net here, but do you think that Tick is the one that we're going to be seeing most of the stories through his eyes?
I mean, most likely the log line for the show is something along the lines of reclaim your birthright. And the, you know, the letter that Tick is reading from his dad that is the impetus for him to return from Florida to Chicago to try to find out where his dad is about reclaiming his inheritance, or, you know, something that he is owed to him from birth, whatever that means. So I think the combination of that being the case, the fact that, you know, the journey is ostensibly to look for his father, and he's the one who has the knowledge of, you know, all of the Lovecraftian kind of like horror tropes. would make that the case. But I think that it's also possible this could be a two-hander with Letty being an audience avatar. I mean, for me, that's definitely my audience avatar.
Totally.
I'm very excited for the part in which we get to praise Journey Smollett, because she was everything for me in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about her now, because like you said, you know, I think even Journey Smollett, and I don't know, this could be a Hollywood thing, I think she gets a credit above Jonathan Majors even, so I don't know if that's an indicator of it possibly becoming a two-hander, but yeah, I mean, she stood out as soon as she stepped into that crowd of just like pure magnetism. Fun fact, I also learned today that Journey Smollett played Michelle Tanner's friend Denise
I was gonna
on
say,
Full House.
She's Hollywood royalty.
I didn't even know that. I was just going to make the joke that when she started singing, she was a regular black canary, but you went way deeper than I did. I only went like a couple months back here.
But it's so interesting to look at Letty's perspective, right? Because there is this idea of the civil rights movement that is sort of like invoked and I think slightly mentioned over the course of this episode because of just where it takes place, even though there are, of course, racist themes pervading. You know, this does all take place north of the Mason-Dixon line, but to hear, you know, Letty's sort of off-screen, you know, really protest-fueled actions is a really interesting way to view the character. She's almost like in her own world, and so I can imagine how charged this idea of coming back to Chicago and interacting with her siblings is, and I'm sure we'll find out more about that situation, but I totally agree with you, LaTanya. Like, she is such an enigmatic, not only actress, but like character as well, that I really cannot wait to unlock that treasure box more.
Yeah. I mean, so I want to start by talking a little bit about Chicago during the 1950s and the Great Migration. Mike, you mentioned earlier that the South Side of Chicago was not idyllic at that time, but it kind of questions idyllic for whom? I'm from the South Side of Chicago. I still live on the South Side of Chicago. It's been a haven for Black people, since, you know, the time of the Great Migration, which began around 1915 and went into the 1970s. And this is according to, like a WTTW DuSable Museum kind of, collaboration. During, you know, this time, there is just a lot of like national upheaval with civil rights. So more than 7 million Black people left the South and headed north. And Chicago was supposed to be the promised land. I know, you know, I have relatives. My grandmother came to Chicago. It's the reason that I live and was born there. So like jobs were better. Wages were better. There were homes with like indoor plumbing and running water. You know, this was like kind of a prime destination for any Black family or Black person who wanted a life that was better for themselves, where they weren't constantly living with the threat of being lynched, essentially, where racism obviously still existed, but it wasn't as overt. And that's mainly due to the fact that Chicago was and still is very segregated by neighborhood. So there were Black spaces that people have still been able to carve out. And the South Side of Chicago is very much a part of that story. In terms of introducing the character of Letty, I mean, she just like the way that she comes in. First of all, she like enters in Technicolor. You know, I mean, I get that everything is in color, but everyone else's clothing is kind of muted greens, grays, blues. And she comes in with these vibrant reds, like these deep, rich red tones. She's at this block party where she goes to see her half sister, Ruby, who is played by the BAFTA award winning actress Wumi Musaku. And Ruby is performing and she's singing. So there's like a lull between songs and she asks for requests. And Letty requests a whole lot of Shakin', a song by Big Maybelle. So they sing together, but you can tell during that performance that there's like a sibling rivalry between the two of them, because there's a point at which Letty kind of like really gets into it and takes the microphone away. And then Ruby's like, okay, settle down. I'm older than you. Calm down. It's just like a sister dynamic is there. And this is the first kind of like opportunity I want to take to shout out HBO's companion podcast. I know it's odd to talk about another podcast on a podcast you're doing, but this,
plug away.
This is a podcast that is, similar to how they've done with Watchmen in the past and before that with Chernobyl. They have a companion podcast hosted by two Black women. One of whom is Ashley C. Ford, who's the writer, and then Shannon Houston, who actually is a writer for the show Lovecraft Country. And one of the really interesting conversations that they started having about the first episode had to deal with Letty and Ruby's dynamic in terms of their family. Because if you notice, Letty's last name is Lewis. Her brother and Marvin and sisters, Ruby's last name is Baptiste. Letty is significantly more fair-skinned than in complexion than her brother and sister are, and they are written as half-brother and sister in here. It's a really interesting conversation about family dynamics, complicated relationships between sisters, especially Black sisters, and how colorism can really impact interfamiliar relationships. So we get this in the conversation that the two siblings have with each other about going to apply for jobs downtown at department stores, which in the 50s would have been almost a feat of impossibility for Black women to work at a department store counter, unless they were the skin color of Letty or could pass for white. So it's the type of probably push and pull they've had in addition to other sisterly kind of like obstacles their entire life. So when Letty and Ruby have that conversation where they talk about moving to a different neighborhood or getting a job at the department store, Letty's expectations are a lot different than the realities that Ruby has to face on a daily basis because Ruby is darker skinned. And it's just the truth. Also, put one of those, just put a mental pin in Ruby, because, Musaku is amazing. She's like a really great actress and she's supposed to have a lot to do coming up in the next couple episodes too.
Yeah, it's interesting because for Leaving Chicago, you know, even when you watch it in the weeks ahead, it seems like we get a lot of reference back to those characters back in Chicago, whether it be Ruby, whether it be Anjanou Ellis as a Hippolyta, who's George's wife, or whether Jada Harris as Diana Freeman. Like, it looks like we're going to go into some crazy eras, which again was another thing that surprised me personally, because I thought, okay, now that we're in Artem, we're going to stay in Artem. But I love the fact, and again, that speaks for that idea of a familial trauma or just like familial strife, perhaps, that I'm glad that we are still staying with that crew in Chicago, because they did such a great job of really illustrating those people. It would be sad to, you know, to leave those characters behind.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and there's something to the idea too. I mean, like, you know, you talked about the POV character and everything, and while I do think Letty and Tick are going to be our main POVs, it's weird because like the central story, I think, is mostly also about, you know, the horrors of being Black in America, and that's not just a story that's going to be told through one area, right? That's not going to be able to just tell that story through those at Artem. So I think jumping back to like the Chicago storylines and everyone there, I think is going to make total sense to kind of really expand that story and really tell it from multiple perspectives about the reality of the situation, not just the, you know, fantastical horrors that, you know, may be happening.
I also think that the characters in Chicago, specifically, Uncle George's family, so Hippolyta and Dee Dee, are going to have a lot more impact on the story because of, as it relates to the lore and mythos. Just if you look at like, kind of like, you know, Hippolyta really wants to get out there on the road. Like, she expresses that she's the one who writes up the best reviews based on the notes that her husband takes, but she wants to get out there with him, when, you know, to travel when he's like working on, visiting places to write the Green Book that he's writing, or the Negro Motorist book. And we see that, you know, Dee is drawing, she likes to make comics, and the one that she's making now is based on a picture of her mother. Mental pins here. Hippolyta is the name of a Greek goddess, who was queen of the Amazons, and
also
known
the mother
for,
of Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah. And known for being a warrior, right? And Dee's drawings, are they prophetic, right? So like in the Atlas, over all of the different places that were in the guides, she's drawn all of these different things, and over where the road trip is taking them, she has the Grim Reaper there. And then she decides to stop working on a comic series that she'd been working on, and instead, gives her dad, when he goes on this trip, a new comic, that has her mother as kind of like the influence for it. So, you know, like what's going to come out of these two characters, even though they're kind of holding it down back home? Are they going to end up staying there? Will they end up out on the road at some point? We don't really know. So I'm interested in figuring out what's going to happen with them.
They're really like extraterrestrially interested, it seemed like, right? Like there's the telescope set up, Orithia Blue, which is the character that she made after her mother. Like her mission is to travel from planet to planet. So I can imagine if Tick's sort of initial fantasies come true and we do see things come down from the stars specifically, I can imagine they're going to have some involvement, Kevin.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Josh mentioned last week, something I didn't know is that they're kind of, taking each episode almost as its own sense of horror and like its own horror story. So certainly aliens are a part of that, right? The idea of the unknown is a big part of horror, especially in that time period in the 50s and 60s, the extraterrestrial stories were huge. I was just going to comment too, you know, like the art in the motorist book, I love that they, you know, drawn in there as the KKK, because I think one, it's not just to like, oh, also these guys are monsters. I think it's also important to just outright state, like some people might be like, oh, not very subtle. And I'm like, mother effer, it doesn't have to be like, sometimes you just got to be reality with the situation and just say the KKK is on the level of goddamn vampires and werewolves. And if anything are worse because they are real, like, you know, I feel like sometimes people get like really up in themselves about like, nah, that wasn't very subtle. And it's just like, sometimes it ain't got to be, because when we were subtle, y'all didn't freaking listen to us. So now we just got to be outright and say what we got to say. Like that stuff, I've seen some criticism on other things about the lack of subtlety. And I'm just like, we tried subtle. It didn't work. Now we just got to tell you, y'all are racist and you got to listen. So like that stuff like that right there, including the KKK, I thought was really great. And I feel like it was the Grim Reaper, but I need to go into my like Arkham vault of stuff, because I feel like that specific image is part of the Lovecraftian mythology. Like I feel like I've seen it in like the Arkham Horror board game or like Mansions of Madness or something. I might be wrong.
Go into your vault. Do it.
Well, yeah, just pull out all my board games.
Let's go into the vault here, and not from a board game perspective, but yeah, let's talk about like the Arkham Artem of it all, because Kevin, I think again, a lot of us modern minded people will think to a series of games by Rockstar that features Batman when they hear the word Arkham. But as you were sort of alluding before we recorded, there are more Lovecraftian origins in that town name than maybe you initially suspect.
Yes, well, I think it's pretty much confirmed at this point that, you know, Arkham Asylum, the famous institution which houses the Joker, Two-Face, and all of Batman's craziest villains, is in fact named after Arkham from Lovecraftian fiction. Arkham, I believe, was a town or a county in which a lot of his stories took place. I do believe the idea of it becoming the name of the publishing house is correct, but the names, sharing the name, is absolutely purposeful, which makes sense. A lot of Lovecraft stories were about the, you know, going insane and losing your mind to like these ideas and creatures that are beyond the realm of normal man. So the idea of insanity and naming Arkham Asylum after that totally tracks. But yes, if anyone's wondering, Arkham Asylum is in fact named after the Lovecraft connection.
Yeah, so we shall see how much Artem compares to Arkham of its similar name. I want to stay on the Uncle George path, because I feel like he's one of the other characters we haven't really spoken about yet. Played by Courtney B. Vance, who I absolutely love. I'm so intrigued, because again, like you said, you know, I think everyone is sort of representing a different POV, a different perspective about the Black experience. And Uncle George really represents something interestingly. But I don't know, LaTanya, when I hear him tell Hippolyta, like, next time you're coming out with me, God, I hope he makes it through this season. I really do.
Yeah,
we thought he was going to die at the end of this one.
I know. I'm very worried about Angela Bassett's husband. I think that... So, like... I love Courtney B. Vance. I just love Angela Bassett more. So when they have that scene where he calls to check in from the road and he can't even really focus on the conversation that he's trying to have with his daughter, after he kind of hears the research report, that we'll talk about, cause Marvin, Letty's half brother really gives them the download on where they're going. So when he hears all of what they're about to face and, you know, Hippolyta does get on the phone, on the line, and he says, you know, I'll take you out on the next trip. Not only does it seem like he is accepting that this might be his last trip, but it seems like she, you know, she takes the phone away, presses it to her heart, and she's just like, okay. She seems to have that realization as well, that this is not a trip like the other trips. And the other trips were already incredibly dangerous. I mean, we hear them discussing, we hear Uncle George talking to Tick earlier, when they're trying to like figure out where this town is exactly. And he's icing his knees. And we learn that both his kneecaps have been busted on these trips, probably because he's been beaten up by some racists and they've broken his kneecaps. So it's already unsafe. Then we're adding, you know, incredibly like, like, racist sheriffs, with like 4-inch thick NAACP complaint files to the mix. And then,
nothing like reality at all. No, I even wrote that on my notes. A racist police officer. I even wrote down afterwards. Oh no, they died.
Just poor them.
Oh darn.
Yeah. But he didn't die though.
He did.
That one didn't.
That's true.
Yeah, that one made it. The rest of them, when the one got eaten, is where I wrote
down. Oh no, he died.
That's the other thing as well. Speaking towards the monster of it all is, you know, I think a lot of comparisons are drawn to Stranger Things, which I think is sort of like the comparison to horror, quote unquote, based, fictional TV based pulp fiction or like sci-fi horror nowadays. But man, Stranger Things would definitely not tear a man's jaw off and just have him like, and that was like, this is HBO. This is clearly HBO. Yeah. They're going there.
Cowards.
have 11 tear a man's jaw off, you cowards.
But to answer your question, I'm very, very much worried about Uncle George, Angela Bassett's husband. He seems to know it. And I mean, you know, it's written off as a little bit of a joke when Tick tells Letty about the Shoggoth, saying, oh, we can outrun those. And then they both laugh. Well, Uncle George can't. Uncle George can't. Like, he literally cannot, because he's got busted knees, you know? So there are going to be parts of this journey that are just going to be physically more difficult for him. In addition to the fact that, who knows how open his mind is to being able to accept some of the more supernatural aspects of what he's about to encounter.
Yeah. I mean, like for me, it was a moment too of like, if you're a cop in a 90s action film and you say like, I'm just one day away from retirement, like,
exactly.
You're just like, oh no, like that is, you know, that is a moment of scare. I was glad that he didn't die at the end of this. I was pretty sure they weren't going to. I feel like they weren't just going to kill off a Black man first, you know, like, so I was glad that did not happen. Obviously, the first episode's over, so they have free reign to do anything now. But I also think, I mean, I don't remember the exact line now, but I think it's pretty much confirmed that his kneecaps were broken by white people. I believe he mentions, like, you know, while icing them, like, oh, unless I have another run in with some crackers. I could be wrong about the exact line, which
I don't think he was talking about saltines.
Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, well, also, like, This is just an aside, but like, one, every time I hear that word, I'm always just like, yeah, I'm glad we can say it on TV. Two, fun story. I definitely knew someone who did not know the origin of the term cracker. I don't know if you know, Mike, but
don't
a lot of people,
do.
A lot of people just assume that it's cracker because, you know, like white, like saltines. No, no, no. It is short for whip cracker. Because that's what y'all did. So,
Wow.
Yeah. So, dropping some future info for anyone who is wondering about that. Yeah. I also, for me, like that knowledge should be shared, and that knowledge also needs a constant reminder again. And the way of subtlety is just like, hey, don't forget this was a thing.
Everyone's got so much reading to do.
And that's what I love about this
or
as well.
Movies to YouTube videos, any way that you know, books on tape, however you consume content that educates you to know what things mean.
Let's talk about a piece that was really used so well, Latonya. You talked about the VOs. I think we need to talk about this travel montage that is, you know, backed up by the infamous debate, I think from like 65, between James Baldwin and William F. Buckley, who I believe was the big guy behind the National Review, which, you know, is a big right wing publication. And that's where the whole, you know, I find myself not for the first time in the position of a kind Jeremiah comes from. This might have been my favorite part of the episode, because if you're talking about thesis statements, I think this idea of creating a reality is so inherent to the show, because this is a brand new reality, obviously, in the very surreal horror elements that we're bringing in. But it's this idea that, you know, people are not, people are not born racist. People are not going to be like, I do not like this because I'm a bad person. This person is racist. They set it to the confines of their own reality, right? They talk about how, you know, people, they're just defending their lands. They're just defending their properties. You know, they're just defending their rights. You put a substantiation to your attitudes that are objectively racist to retrofit your own reality. I think James Baldwin puts it so well, and I loved putting it that there over the montage as well, where we really got to go outside of Chicago. And even though we experienced it a bit in that opening scene, we really get to see for the first time what this America is like. And what I loved especially was, and I think Ava DuVernay actually noticed this on Twitter, is that a lot of the images and shots that they used are imagery from Gordon Park, who was this famous photographer who took a lot of famous photos of segregation. And they used like literal exact carbon copies of the signs and imagery that was used there. And I thought that was just like a delicious pastry of history in the course of a 5-minute package. And I really loved every morsel of it.
Yeah. I mean, that part I think was just, I got chills, because James Baldwin's voice for me is so distinctive. When I hear it, I recognize it immediately, whether I can see the face or not. You know, for those of you all who aren't familiar with James Baldwin, prolific Black American novelist, playwright, poet, essayist, songwriter, activist, you know, honestly, if you don't know who James Baldwin is by now, I'm not going to do that work for you. You should do it. You can start with I Am Not Your Negro, which is on Netflix. But there's a great article that's on Lit Hub by Gabrielle Below called Baldwin versus Buckley, a debate that we shouldn't need as important as ever, which is about that 1965 debate that Baldwin had against Buckley at Cambridge, where Baldwin had to defend the position that the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro. And it was one of those situations where it was just like, for Baldwin, it was just like, how is this a debate about anything? Of course, the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro. We literally built this country for you, and you've given us nothing, and you keep murdering us, and you dehumanize us on a constant basis. But yet, in all of the advertising, you know, we're supposed to go out, like, we're supposed to take part in the American dream, yet you keep it from us, you know? But here we are in 2020, having that exact same debate, So it really is just the, it, you know, as timely as ever, to use a phrase that I hate using. But like, yeah, the quote itself, that the proposition before the house, that I would put it this way, the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro, played over the montage of, you know, just people, them stopping at a gas station. And then like, there are these white people that are like mimicking like monkeys at them. And they have to hurry up and get back in the car because they, if there's any type of violence that occurs, it's ultimately going to be to the, you know, detriment of the black people in our party. Right. And it really gives us this idea of horror, and horrific things being contextual and being about, your lived experience, right? So something that is terrifying to me, you may not find terrifying, and vice versa. I once, when Get Out first came out, was teaching a group of high school students, and one of the students was like, "Oh, LT, I saw Get Out. I didn't think it was scary." And I was like, of course, young white girl from the suburbs, you would not think that Get Out was scary because it. Yes.
How do you like your cereal?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you, of course you wouldn't think it was scary. None of this affects you. You don't have to feel existential dread for your life on a constant basis. So we kind of see, and hear the group in Woody, which is the name of the car, which I think is super cute, that they're like getting mocked. We see like a line of black people, standing. It looks like they're waiting for work, cause they've got like lunch pails and everything. Mm. And they're in front of a sign that reads, "There's no way, like the American way." And you know, our heroes are exiting a movie theater, but they're coming out. This is one of the Gordon Parks, photography, like, recreations, actually. They're, when they're coming out of the movie theater with a shot that says "for coloreds only" entrance. And then they, Tick goes over and like buys a rose from a woman, a black woman who's like holding a baby. She's selling roses outside of a movie theater to support her kid. You know, all of this, you know, crap that we're fed from a very young age about the American dream and what it can mean. It doesn't mean the same thing for black people that it does for everyone else. It doesn't mean the same thing for brown people or queer people that it means for everyone else. And that's just, it's situational, it's contextual, and there's no better way to sum that up than the words of James Baldwin.
Yeah, the entire, like, that entire sequence was just so well executed and well handled, not just from a storytelling and I think cinematography, directing, creative standpoint, just... Like Lasagna is alluding, there's just so much there of reality and anxiety inducing moments that, you know, it's weird because like it's kind of like what I was saying earlier about being subtle, too. Like you look at stuff like this, you have these moments and it's just like, man, people were terrible back in the 60s. And it's just like you could easily have this be right now and it's still the same. And I think a moment that really kind of hit that for me that I really liked was when they drove past the billboard that had Aunt Jemima on there. And I think that was great because like that is something that was showing of the time, right? Like the 1960s. But until recently, again, guess who was still around?
Yeah, I was going to say, I know that timely is a word that we like to stay away from, but that just felt super prescient given the time that they probably
also
filmed this.
Like, exactly. Those people from the 50s and 60s, a lot of them are still alive.
Yes. Yeah, so I think people need to know, like, this was only 60 years ago. Like, you could have been a teen in this period, and you still are alive now.
Yeah, I mean,
you could be alive at the time saying and doing these terrible things and be president of the United States of America.
Yeah. We just lost Representative John Lewis, who is, like, a huge person in the civil rights movement. Like, he just died. That shows the longevity of people. It was not that long
ago. He just died and was taken across the racist bridge. You know, that he was beaten upon. I mean, you know, it's just it's all woven into America. Like that is the American dream. The American dream is more like a nightmare for the majority of people. And there are moments, I think that the show is wonderful about not only pointing that out in such like beautiful cinematic ways, but also just making moments of like just joy and love in between those times, you know, like in between the time that they're getting gas and then have to like get in the car to get away because of they're being mocked. Like Letty and Tick are just like laughing and having a good time. They're listening to music in the car. You know, they're enjoying themselves. They stop and see a movie. You know, there's like the opening scene where we're introduced to George and Hippolyta. They're like in bed as a couple. It's like a lived in feeling of a relationship, which is black love that we don't get to see on the screen. So like it's the highs and the lows. It's the pleasure and the pain that's all a part of being black in America that is so much a part of this show, and such a big reason I really love this episode.
I want to talk about Simmonsville because I do feel like, to the points that you both made before, huge turning point. I mean, this is where you could especially tell from a musical perspective. Like, we had had a lot of standards played with the occasional hip hop song that gets thrown in there on occasion, which I know LaTanya.
We had some early Tierra Whack happen.
Yeah, exactly. And now all of a sudden, like, we really get, I think, what you would call like a standard horror pulse pounding, you know, once we find out about the diner and, you know, essentially the fate that befell it beforehand. And then it becomes, let's race out of the town and engage in this high speed chase. And also, I believe that the first profanity of the show is let out there when Letty says, you know, we need to get the F out of here. And I think that's so interesting because, again, it's this idea of like reality shattering. In a manner of speaking, like, even though we have seen these big visceral images, like you guys spoke about in the montage, that's really the first time when I think these three are faced with like immediate threats on their lives. And so that reality just comes, you know, even though we're going to have another dose of reality coming in the form of these creatures later on, that is really the first time that I agree with you both that it's like, oh, holy shit. Okay. Now you see the urgency of what their lived in reality is.
And it's a weird, crazy thing. Like, I mean, I think, you know, I think to an extent it's yes, but I also think that that's, I don't want to say it's somewhat of that white POV too, but like there is a lot of moments and a lot of the horror that occurs and a lot of tension that are more smaller and subtle that I think, you know, existed throughout, you know, like in those moments at the gas station amongst the happiness, you always, I think there's something there about like always having to be ever vigilant to your surrounding and your world that we constantly have to be. And I think Simmonsville sets off a course that also speaks even deeper to it, right? Like as a person of color, and especially for, you know, black people of color, it's so difficult to walk the line that you can't see, because that's what it ultimately is. The, like, if you look at the people, not even, you know, the people in Simmonsville, but if you look at the sheriff and you look at the conversations that happen, you are trying to figure out the exact right thing to say. And they walk a line that is on the floor, but you're blindfolded and you don't know where that line is. You could come off too smart alecky and you say the wrong thing. You could come off too dumb and that's the wrong thing to say. You're constantly having to figure out and know what you can do to literally just survive. And I think that's something that they emphasized and executed so well in that entire encounter, even going to a restaurant. You know, you have your someone older like George who is just like, well, we're here. This is where we're going to eat, versus Tick and Lito, who are just kind of like, no, we should not be here. Like, this is bad. This is going to be bad. Which I think is, again, like those gut feelings, those things of being ever vigilant. And so you have that at an all-time high, and I think this is where it really hits the entire audience, and the entire audience can feel that tension. The entire audience can feel the anxiety skyrocket through the roof in these moments. It's where the threat becomes real. The threat is always there. It's been there, you know, but this is where it's actually taken action now. And that entire chase sequence, I mean, the idea of, like, I don't know, I'm sure there's someone out there, and I'd like to not meet them because I would say mean things, but I'm sure there's someone out there who's probably just like, it's so silly, I have to get out before sundown, and they're chasing the sun, and it's just like, yeah, that's what it is. I don't think you understand what sundown laws are, you know, like, so like, yeah, people have been already talking, like, who didn't know sundown laws the same way that Watchmen, you know, people didn't know about Tulsa, and that's an interesting question for me, because, like, that's always just like, oh, yeah, people didn't know about this, huh?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is the American educational system's fault. You know, no one taught anyone any of this. Not even at schools where the population of both teachers and students were predominantly Black, because the textbooks that that teachers are forced to use, like are part of the mandatory curriculum, are not written by people who look like me. You know, they're written by white, like they're mass produced by white people. And, you know, the quote unquote victors are the ones that get to tell the story of history. And, you know, they're the people that get to leave out things that happened. So, of course, no like white person who publishes a textbook wants to put in that they, you know, have descendants that blew up Black Wall Street in Tulsa. we don't get to learn about it. And then when a project like the 1619 project comes along, for example, and teachers want to put that into the curriculum, they get so much blowback as a result of it, just because they're trying to educate their students better. I mean, this scene, the Simmonsville scene was so tense for so many reasons, because, you know, you're coming in and you see those people just staring, and that dog is being racist. And then, you know, the original place that they're looking for is supposed to be a red brick building called Lydia's. And, you know, they see something that looks like it, but the name has been changed to the Simmonsville dinette. And they note that, like, you all said, you know, Tick and Letty are dubious, and they're like, you know, we don't need to eat here. Like, in a couple hours, we'll be at Marvin's. It's not that big of a deal. And Uncle George is the one who's like, we're here. We have a right to be. Our money spends. And then, you know, this is the first time that Letty gets to save the day. And I'll do my moment of quiet reverence for Letty, followed by like, oh my God, Letty moment here. because she implements a practice that I have been putting into place for years, which is, as they would say in Clueless, you have to do a lap before you commit to a location, right? So in the before time, when I would go to a restaurant, I always go to the bathroom before, sitting down at the table, like everyone else sits there. I go to the bathroom because you like get to walk past the kitchen. You see like what the setup is. You do a lap before you commit to a location, right? So Letty probably does this more so, because she's been on the road and not because it's a surveillance thing, but she does learn some very important information, while she's doing this. And so her, like, her line reading of screaming, to get up, we have to get the F out of here now, is like, obviously it's a very tense situation, but it's so funny. She's just so hilarious and just like so on top of it. And it's just like, we're not messing around. We have to get out of here. Also, the super cool thing when Tick is like, Uncle George, why is the White House white?
Yeah.
Was just such cool signaling. That's just, you know, a thing between like an uncle and a nephew where they've obviously like shared a lot of like, they've read books together. They've like, you know, they've bonded over geeky things together. So they have this like shorthand and they can say something like, why is the White House white? And figure out they're in a trouble, like a problematic, a troubling situation. And then Letty comes like roaring out of that bathroom. And finally the girl gets to drive, which is great.
Yeah.
So
and she kicks ass at it.
She does amazing.
She's Letitia effing Lewis.
She's Letitia effing Lewis. Like everything that she's doing, the strut, like all of the looks that she's serving, her confidence, like the side eye over the glasses that she gives to those white women that are passing them by in front. The fact that she's the photographer and she uses that as like a bit of a weapon at a certain point to like, against the Shoggoth monsters. But also I wonder, you know, because we're wondering what her backstory is. We learn later that she's been in DC and like has gotten some people out of prison, bailed people out of jail. What other type of monsters has her photography already exposed or will expose? Mm. And also she can run through the woods without falling. Which is, I mean, who knew?
An accomplishment for horror.
Who knew that in horror, a woman could run swiftly and be afraid through the woods and not fall down? I mean, she's great.
Well, speaking of bigger mysteries, I do want to talk about something that does end up very unexpectedly ending that chase out of Simmonsville. It's the show up of this mysteriously tinted gray car. And a blonde woman steps out. I initially thought it was Alexis Bledel, a.k.a. Rory Gilmore. But no, it is. I believe it's Abby Lee, who's playing Christina Braithwaite, who is going to have, spoiler alert, have a larger role in the series overall. But, I mean, that was definitely, you know, in an episode that obviously had white characters few and far between them, and they did. They were obviously very different characters from flipping over cars of racists. It was an interesting way to debut a character that we did not see throughout the rest of the episode.
I definitely also just had white girl blindness when she showed up, because when I saw her, even my girlfriend was just like, that's like a person, right? And then we looked it up and was like, not really. Like, she was in Fury Road briefly, but she just looked like just some like famous white girl, I guess. It's because like we both had a moment where we're just like, that's a person. And just like, oh no, it's not. I mean, we're excited to see where she ends up. I have theories about that, because, not to jump too far ahead, at the end of the episode, we see the silver car at the mansion they go to, and the door opens, and there's a guy who looks very similar to her. Mm-hmm. And like, as a person who's played the BioShock games and love them, there's a thing in BioShock Infinite where I was like, is this a Lutestuin situation? But I'm excited to find out about that. That's just a fun nerdy moment for me. But
I don't know what that means, and I refuse to respond to it.
Just, we'll just say infinite universes. That's all I'll say. Right? The infinite lighthouses. Okay.
Got it.
But that moment, we had to, we also rewound. I'm sure people caught it at this point, but like, when it first happened, like, that the chase is happening, the silver car comes out, flips around, and the other car flips over. And I remember turning to my girlfriend and just, my fiance, I have to keep remembering
that. Yeah, she's your fiance.
Congratulate Kevin.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, did you see that? And she's like, the car flipped over. And I was like, wait, but did you see how? And she's like, it didn't just swerve. And I was just like, ooh. So we backed it up. And it's just like, no, something clearly happened. Yeah. It did not come close to touching that car and just flipped up into the air. So there's clearly a lot of cool stuff there as well. And again, another situation where, oh no, those racists died. Such a tragedy.
Yeah, exactly. Small violin. But it could be, again, to pull back to Stranger Things, it could be like a psionic power type thing. Because it did look like, at least from my perspective, that car hit a force field or something. And that's what caused it to flip over. So that could be yet another element of science fiction that we're dealing with altogether outside of just the supernatural.
I'm excited. Just throw it all in.
Yes. I mean, and that's actually a perfect segue into like where we end up, right? Like,
yeah,
we have this chase happen. You know, they had the entire encounter with the sheriff shortly after that, which, again, the tension there is just palpable, because it's just, what is the right thing to say? What can you say? There is no right thing to say, ultimately, right? Because that's where we end up. And I think too often that's true here. There is no right thing to say. They're looking for an excuse. They're always looking for an excuse. ACAB. You know, you get into the situation where even when they've made it out of town, even when they cross the line to where they need to be, there's still something there waiting for them, waiting to stop them. There was no escape. And in a way, that's always the case, right? Like, It's such a just unfortunate reality that just speaks to every, you know, person of color's experience in this country. But like, it's also devastating to see happen to your characters you've been following, think they're going to make it out, and then they don't, and they get taken into the woods. And again, in that perspective of like, what do you say? What's the right thing? Where Tick is just continuously trying to say the right thing, trying to, you know, make sure they get out of this alive if they can. But then obviously things take a hell of a turn.
Can we talk about the lore that we learn at Marvin's house that gets us into that scene in the woods?
About Eustace Hunt?
Yeah, of course.
So Marvin is Letty's half-brother, and that's the destination they're going to after they eventually get out of the first car chase in Simmonsville. He's played by Demetrius Gross, and he has been doing some research and gives us kind of the lore of Devon County. And apparently the town is called Bideford, and it was named after a town in England with one of the last witch trials. And the trial occurred because a woman there said that she had sex with the devil, who appeared to her in the form of a black man, which... Okay. but apparently there's been a bunch of missing people in the area. And there's rumors that there could be like both supernatural things in the woods, as Kevin was just talking about, but also, there's this Sheriff Hunt, person who's the one that has this huge NAACP complaint file, that eventually, you know, catches our heroes, after the second car chase that these poor people have to endure, and takes them into the woods. Just like I wanted to say real quick about, how I thought it was interesting that there were two different arguments happening, between two different families during that scene, one inside the house and one outside of the house. We still, like, this is more lending to the backstory that we are eventually, hopefully, going to get fulfilled for Letty, and figure out, like, what exactly it was with her, family that led her to not show up for her mother's funeral, because that seems to be a big issue with both her sister and her brother. And then we also have this conversation between Uncle George and Tick, where, you know, Tick is again expressing some stories that seem pretty unpleasant about his dad. And Uncle George comes to his defense a little bit, his dad's defense, saying that, you know, they had it rough when they were growing up, and that, Tick's dad had it the hardest. And then Tick kind of like turns it back around on Uncle George to say, you know, you didn't protect me when I was, you know, was going through that same thing with him. So it's kind of like two different family dynamics, both dealing with generational trauma inside the house and outside the house. And eventually, you know, Letty learns that, you know, she's going to have to go with the family that you choose, not the family that, you know, you're born with. And she ends up back in the car, with Tick and Uncle George. I just wanted to stop down there. Yes, let's please get into this terrifying, horrifying slow speed car chase with Sheriff Hunt.
Well, but actually, before we do, because I do want to stop down and talk for a second about the character of Montrose, Tick's father, who we haven't seen yet. Because, like, again, his presence is so felt. I mean, he is the reason why Tick is going to Artem at this point. But even, like, I found it such a moving yet such a compelling scene when Tick drops by his father's place and you see things like the impressions in the plaster on the wall that Tick brings up later as, you know, apparently when Tick, Tick had obviously joined the army, but apparently what really set Montrose over the edge was finding out that, you know, Tick was going to be profiled for a piece to inspire other black people to join the army. And Montrose has this mentality of, you know, why are you defending a country that does not respect you as a person? And it's such an interesting POV and how much that sort of manifests in what seems to be a schism between the two of them. You know, Tick really alludes to the fact of, like, hey, he's my dad, but he and I don't really get along. And again, if we're talking about literature choices, I found it so interesting that at Montrose's place, Tick found the Count of Monte Cristo by Dumas, because that is a story about a man who was wrongfully imprisoned, you know, just out of pure jealousy, and essentially was deprived what he had the right to. And I can imagine that somebody like Montrose, who, again, I'm so excited to see, and not just because it's Michael K. Williams, but also because it's played by Michael K. Williams.
Yeah.
But just like this character seems to have such a unique point of view in this portion of time, especially compared to his own son, who is set now sort of like growing up in the midst of all this, that to see their dynamic and to see how Montrose and his own view of the world got him into what is assumingly going to be a very harrowing situation, it was a really nice planted seed, in my opinion, Kevin.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Well, like you said, having Michael K. Williams play this character that is we are yet to see is very exciting. I mean, at some point Omar's coming, but not yet in this
just
first episode.
For the farmer Odell.
Yeah. What's also interesting about that is such a fascinating thing, because like his argument and his anger about the situation, I'm not going to say like it's understandable, but like what he said, but his rage is, because like that's something that I find fascinating. I actually had a very deep conversation with one of my close friends with a little while back, especially at the start of all this recently, that the reaction we have and the way we take in the atrocities of our worlds, we can react differently. For my friend, he often has reacted with just nihilism and just kind of like just sadness about it all, right? Versus me, who is angry about it all. Like my instinct on this stuff is anger and rage. Anyone who knows me knows that's not super surprising. So like I tend to like want to lash out. I tend to want to be angry. I tend to want to like just burn it all down. Screw it. So like in that way, I understand even before any of this, the perspective of that character. I think it was such a weirdly relatable thing for me, where it's not even like what he says, but just his feeling about it. Right. Like just the idea of just like, why would you do this? Why encourage people to defend this country that hates you? And like, not again, not even saying like right or wrong about the POV, but just that rage, that just wanting to lash out and be angry and hateful, I absolutely get. So that part was fascinating to me because it's also very different from like almost Tick's POV on stuff, right? Like he is not his, like his father, it seems. He is not just ready to lash out and rage against the past. He wants to clearly remember it and feel it, but that's not the way he's approaching these things, which I found that entire dynamic that we, again, haven't even seen this character, but that character work already was really interesting to me.
Yeah. And I know there's also really going back to the letter that he wrote. I found it, again, going back to the fantastic writing you were talking about, LaTanya, there were a couple of like either misspelled or mispronounced words from Tick's part that are so pertinent. He says, you know, the past is a living thing. You own it, and then corrects himself to say owe it. And those are two completely different words, right? One is about really owning what has come before you, and one is paying homage to it, or paying a debt that your ancestors have sort of paid ahead to you. And the other one was that, you know, I think it was your sacred birthright, and then he changed it to secret birthright, which will play really interestingly into this whole manor idea, which will similarly be linked with Tick's deceased mother. But this idea, again, two very different words, secret and sacred, where one is just like kept hush hush and one is like the golden goose, right? This thing that is the American dream, the thing you want to reach for. So I'm very intrigued to find out, you know, again, I think those word choices are purposeful to see what this birthright is going to be that apparently Montrose and Tick have, whether it's sacred, whether it's secret, or whether it's both.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's fast forward. Let's go to that again. The chasing the sun, as it literally was. You know, the Shoggoth. It's so interesting how a lot of shows that bring in monsters, I'm thinking about Buffy, Kevin, I know you do, basically every week as well, this idea of like how your monster of the week factors into the matters at hand. And I just found it so interesting how the Shoggoth was described as a blob with 100 eyes. And then we get two showdowns with the police, right? It's this idea of how there are eyes everywhere representing an amorphous blob of an organization. And just when you think you escape one set of eyes, you drive into another few. And so I'll be intrigued to see personally if monsters sort of inform the characters that they meet, the action that's going on. But I think it was fantastically on the nose, in my opinion, for this first round, LaTanya.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like that's definitely something I picked up on. And just how insidious, the police presence is, period, but you know, the way that it like creeps into the frame here, like, you know, it's very much, I think that what Green does with this scene is phenomenal because it accomplishes a lot. The first thing that it does is set up, you know, once again, the sheer horror of being Black in America, especially when the cops are on the scene. You know, the first kind of like car chase that we get is just like some angry white mob, right? But these are like, this is the cops. The next thing it does is that it exposes just the base level of idiocy that like these people are working with. they're so insulted just and intimidated by the fact that there's an intelligent black man speaking to this cop, right? Like, that's, I mean, one of the things that Hunt and like the other officers later when they're in the woods, like to throw around is like this, you know, like talking about Tick, he thinks he's so smart, you know, like you can't, you're not allowed to be smart. You're not allowed to be intelligent or try to like anticipate traps that they're trying to set for you. Because if you do, then you're uppity or whatever, and you deserve to be put into your place. And the third thing that I think that it does is it does without like having to be like heavy handed about it at all. It realistically exposes how seriously uninformed and misguided people are who think that like there's a reform possibility when it comes to the police, in my opinion. Jen Jackson, who is a scholar and political scientist at Syracuse University, said that reforms do not work. In Minneapolis, before George Floyd was killed, police there had already undergone extensive anti-bias training and engaged in other reformist options for reducing police violence. Obviously, that's not something that worked in that case. It's not something that worked in many other cases wherein black people were murdered by the police. And this is a cinematic reminder that the police were derived from slave patrols, and they are still very much taking that role up in society today, which is why a disproportionate number of black people are murdered by the police on a daily basis. Black and brown people are murdered and imprisoned every day at a rate that should not be imaginable, and yet it is reality. And it doesn't matter how many times we appeal to the system for change, how many times we complain to organizations like the NAACP, like about this sheriff that we're talking about now, people just disappear in that area. And it's not all because of the monsters that are in the woods. It's because of the monsters that are in cop cars. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think that that scene is so effective at just building a type of tension that you will only have ever felt if you've been in that situation. It's similar to that like empathic feeling that you get the first time you watch a Get Out, for example. Everyone in the audience, no matter what their color, are put into this situation where it's just like you have 7 minutes to get out of this county, and you have to drive at the speed limit and request to be able to make a U-turn before you can do it in a demeaning way. And the whole time you're being followed by the cop that is ramming you from behind, and you're just trying to make it across the train tracks, and you have a second of like momentary joy and exuberance that you've made it, and then you're caught in a dragnet. Because that was the intention the whole time.
Exactly. And I think that's the big thing. The attention is always the fear, the make you feel like you're below, that you're give you an idea, a taste of like thinking you're in control, but then the reality of you not being. I mean, that's what it's all about for like these types of people, right? And I think, you know, the reform aspect is absolutely relevant to today. I mean, it's so weird because not weird, but like in this regard, it's like if that were true, no one in this country would do drugs, right? Because we all had a D.A.R.E. program or someone right. come into our school to be like, we're going to teach you about drugs and why they're bad. And that's why in America, especially, no one does drugs. Like, it's just, it's such a ridiculous notion. The idea is just like, well, as long as we tell them it's bad, and it's just like, don't do that. And they go, okay, we won't. Then great, problem solved. Let's carry on. It's insane. It's why it's systemic. And that's what people seem to not understand, that the people who are doing it are also, you know, essentially perpetuated by the people who are trying to correct it. They're not correcting it. They're not really trying. They're trying to placate everyone else complaining. I mean, that's what it really is all about. And, you know, this is obviously a situation from 60 years ago, but it still hasn't changed. Like, nothing has changed in a way of what that is. And so it's handled really well in towards the timely thing. But as Latanya said before, it's not about we say timely, but really it's just timeless is what it boils down to. And like, yeah, you have that entire sequence, which was just, you know, tense and pulse pounding. You have the moment of just like you're holding your breath, and then they let you be like, OK, let the audience release their breath. You're like, whew. And then like you have to get it again because right then and there, which is for horror, by the way, just phenomenal. Oh, yeah. Horror,
yeah.
Like,
Chef's kiss.
Yes, well done horror, like directing and storytelling. And then you have the moment where they go into the woods, and then the metaphorical becomes literal, right? Where now that you know the sun is down, the monsters, the other monsters come out. Which for me too, that obviously this is where the show becomes like full out traditional horror in a way.
Yeah, it was very reminiscent to me of like Quentin Tarantino's From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yes.
I don't know if you ever saw, where I when I first saw that, I was like 14 years old, and I'm like, oh, this is like a fun like crime thriller, and then in the middle, spoiler alert, vampires show up.
Yep.
And
yep.
I flipped as shit when I saw that happen. And I would love to hear from people if anyone out there like had no idea what Lovecraft Country was about going into this. I would love to hear people's reactions to that moment when those monsters came in, because that must have been like one of the biggest WTF moments in TV in a while if you truly did not know what was coming.
Yeah, my mom was very upset with me that I didn't warn her.
You're like, I didn't know that was gonna happen.
No, she was like, I will listen to your podcast. I cannot watch this show. It is terrifying, and you know I hate being scared. I don't know why you would do this. Next time, choose a podcast about music or something that won't terrify me to the point where I can't sleep. So yeah, I would like to hear some of those stories as well. And I'll be interested if we find Josh to hear what type of experience.
Josh is gone. He disappeared in those woods.
Yeah, that's exactly the reason why he left. He saw the Shaggots and he's like, no more. I'm out. This was my limit. These two eyes will not be seeing any more hundreds of eyes.
Josh does have that eye problem. We talked about that last week. Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually the thing. Probably, though, his worst nightmare would be a creature that had 100 eyes. Luckily, the remedy was not having to poke all 100 eyes. Instead, it was just an aversion to light. But yeah, I mean, this is another thing where it sort of is like, Kevin, when you were describing, it's sort of like a roller coaster when you go over a hill and then it like banks for a second and then you go under a deeper hill and then it almost goes through again with the appearance of these monsters where all of a sudden now it just breaks into an all-out chase. And where it's this weird dynamic where you have two of the police officers with Letty and Tick in the cabin, and it seems like for a second that like things break down a bit when everyone's just trying to work together to survive, but Hunt still Hunt. You know, there's still power dynamics that are being established as well. And I do not think it's you know, coincidental that he's one that's turned into one of those creatures, right? Like you guys said, the one monster turns into another in a manner of speaking. And so it does make sense entirely that he is the one to become this monster that, to your point, does not technically die, does get driven away, so maybe he comes back at some portion of time. But man, what a delightfully wackadoo way to end the episode.
It was great, like, when that happened, too, because I remember talking to my fiancé as we were watching and being like, you know, so do we think that there is actually going to be, like Cthulhu-like monsters that are going to show up? Do you think it's more like a looming presence, which was sort of a thing in Lovecraft, if I'm not mistaken? Again, I haven't read them, I just sort of know the whole thing where it's like, it's there, but it's never like fully like, here we are, you know, like the rest, half the story, halfway into the story, they're here and you fight them. And so when that happened though, and it's just like, they're there and all of a sudden just whoosh, and that one loses, his entire body's gone, his arm is left. I was just like, whoop, yep, I guess we are. Like here it is.
Is happening.
I just love also, like, you know, I talked a lot about one of the things I loved about Get Out and things like Started to Bother You and what like N.K. Jemisin did with Broken Earth is the storytelling possibilities that they introduced me to in a way of taking these tropes and recontextualize them in a way to speak towards and for people of color. And it's so simple, but at the same time, to me, just so freaking brilliant. Where it's just like, one, the episode is called Sundown. And two, it's about the horror of sundown laws. Like when the sun goes down, there is just death waiting. They literalize that in this episode. And I just love that idea of just like, almost in a way, it's just like, well, how do we, you know, how would we do vampires? And it's just like, well, sundown laws. And like that parallel, I just think, you know, some people might be like, oh, well, isn't it, again, isn't it too obvious? And to that, again, I say like you, but I really like that. I really like the literalization of that horror element. The idea of Sundown Laws becoming actual monsters, I thought was really great. And also as a person who just freaking loves vampires, I just binge the hell out of What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh
and
my god,
every second so of funny.
It. It's
so funny.
So good. So good. you know, obviously this is a very different interpretation of these vampires, lest one of those monsters stood up and started being like, this is a very strange circumstance and I do not yeah. understand it. Bat form. And then just flies
yeah. away. I mean, listen, I would not want to imagine Colin Robinson back in these times. considering he's the energy vampire, like I think he's like unfortunately having a good time yeah. during these times right now.
Yeah. Colin Robinson is enjoying life during yeah. this time. I love vampires as well. I think that vampires were kind of my first like monster that I really like latched on to horror wise when I was younger, just because of how cool they were. And then like when I was a teenager, I didn't realize that I thought vampires were attractive, and that's why I thought they were cool. these are not those kinds of vampires. They're not attractive. They're blobs with tons of eyes, and they can burrow into the ground. That was like super creepy when that happened.
They do play baseball, though. Just FYI, we didn't see it, but they do play baseball in the woods.
Oh, great! you're referencing Twilight.
Correct.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
not those vampires. Other vampires. But
I love all vampires of all shapes, sizes, and sparkles.
That's oh, wonderful. But I thought the shorthand again that came into play between Tick and Uncle George, the listen to them, children of the night, like reference to quoting Dracula, and they are like, oh, vampires, we need to stay hidden until it's light out again. That, and then like, you know, Letty having to like run to the car, and actually gets there, uses the headlights, uses the car itself to like go into that like shack that they kind of find themselves in. And then that beautiful scene that kind of wraps up that scene before there's a whistle that calls them all away. That's odd, and I'm sure has something to do with magical car white lady, Abby Lee.
Yeah, and MCWL, magical car white lady, I think yes. is what we could call it from now on.
It's
yeah,
the technical term.
I'm going to imagine so, right? Because it is interesting to me how after this whole experience, right, because they're looking for Artem and they can't find it, right? It's almost like Terabithia, where they're like, like, it's not on the map, like, we have to cross this bridge. And it's so interesting to me how until they have that experience, they can't find it. But then once they do, you see them like very, you know, soberly walk under that covered bridge and
right.
walk into Artem. And I do wonder if part of it is like, again, maybe this is more of a mythical element, but like now that you have seen what can be in this world, now you can be open to it. Now you can have access to it. You've sort of like passed the first test in that regard. And so maybe to that point, maybe this secret society that involves, you know, our magical car white lady and her possible twin brother, the butler, might involve like taming and maybe harboring some of these creatures in the area.
We can call him door opening white dude.
Yeah.
Dowd.
Two things. One, I love this contrast between magical black character, now the magical white car lady. So that's great.
Right.
I loved it. I love the inversion here. And the second thing too, speaking of vampires, like yeah, when Lita crashed through the wall of the cabin with the car, I literally was just like, I wanted her to get out of the car and just be like, the one thing about Artem I never could stomach. All the damn vampires. Referencing arguably my favorite vampire film, The Lost Boys. That's like, since we're here on it, and we kind of had a similar thing last week, I'm just curious to now talk about, like, yeah, what are some of your favorite vampire flicks
yeah,
you have?
Let's,
for me,
let's
definitely...
we're sort of finishing up here, so now I'm intrigued. Yeah. Let's have some vampire talk.
Yeah, so similarly as LaTanya, vampires I got into super young, probably like the first big monsters I got into, and a lot of that was I think attributed to The Lost Boys. I was and still am obsessed with that film. Kiefer Sutherland is great in it, as is Richard Gilmore from the Gilmore Girls, who plays the head vampire. But I love that film so much. And I would say, like, next to that, the original version of Let the Right One In, I think, is phenomenal.
The Australian
phenomenal.
One?
I think it wasn't Australian. I think it was Swedish?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. But, like, those are two of my favorites, along with, oh, man, I'm trying to remember. Now there's one. It's with Bill Paxton and Chris or Lance Hendrickson. It's blanking on it, but it's a really another really great one. But those are probably up there for me as my two favorites, I would say.
What about you, LaTanya?
I have so many that I like. I'm looking right now. I mentioned Blackula last week as kind of like a foundational vampire text for me. The Lost Boys was another, like, very young, like, the Corey's obsession was, you know, all the rage for anyone who grew up during, like, the late 80s, early 90s. And I was definitely a fan of the Corey's, and so I had to see anything that the Corey's were in. So the Lost Boys was just, I mean, it's on my DVR now. Like, I will still revisit that movie. I really love it. I thought it was really cool how Us used that, like, boardwalk, from the Lost Boys as well. Vampire in Brooklyn is just, like, hilarious. I really like A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night as a more recent, vampire movie. And then probably Interview with the Vampire. Just because that was, like, I mean, like, Brad Pitt and at the time Tom Cruise, because I didn't at the time know about Scientology when that movie came out.
I also feel like that movie was, like, that was probably the first version I can really think of like the whole vampires are hot thing, right?
Because
before that, because I was gonna ask you guys, like, who is your Dracula of choice, right? Because I feel before that, when you're looking at, like, Bela Lugosi or, like, Gary Oldman, it was more about the menace than it was about the looks.
Gary Oldman definitely had a look, like, there's many a girl my age and a few guys who were very into Gary Oldman and Dracula. I do think Anne Rice changed the perception of vampires from just horrific creatures into tragic characters. I think that I can maybe attribute to Anne Rice's writing specifically. Before then, vampires were seductive monsters, right? And I think Anne Rice kind of made them into the idea of the tragedy of being a vampire, and that can bring in, like, to an extent, because of Anne Rice. Anne Rice walked so Edward Cullen could run like a deer, I guess. But, like, without, I think, Anne Rice, there is no Twilight, like, full stop.
I also just remembered this show that my aunt got me into that I became obsessed with, Dark Shadows. I think there are two versions of Dark Shadows.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so there was
a very bad movie.
Yeah, my in-laws love a Dark Shadow. So Dark Shadows was like a 1970s soap opera.
Yes.
About a vampire family.
Which I have seen all of.
Yeah, and so it was made into a movie starring Johnny Depp that was not very good. And then I believe, it was briefly remade into a TV series as well. That I think is very, unfortunately, unlike a vampire, it is plain old dead, not undead. It has not seen the light of day, much like vampires.
Yeah, I mean, like, the thing about it is, yes, Anne Rice is credited with making them more desirable and tragic. But I think that the whole, even when they were supposedly, like, ugly figures, like, the whole allure of them is the fact that they are undead and immortal and can give you that same immortality, combined with just kind of, like, whatever seductive power they are supposed to have. I think it's a power dynamic thing, honestly, that makes people attracted to vampires. Like, the combination of that and the undead. But yeah, I don't know who my favorite Dracula is.
Gerard Butler in Dracula 2000, that phenomenal film.
Or whoever played Dracula in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie with Sean Connery.
Again, I know who it's not. Probably Bela Lugosi, because that's the first one I saw.
I believe,
yeah,
Christopher Lee might have been the first vampire to show fangs.
It was Christopher Lee then that I thought, yeah. I definitely thought Christopher Lee was attractive, like a young Christopher Lee, which says something about me.
Even older Christopher Lee.
Talk to my therapist about later. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, yeah, I love vampires. I did know that that From Dusk Till Dawn was about vampires, which is why I saw it in the first place.
Same.
I could have done without whatever Quentin Tarantino's character was doing in that movie.
I mean, you could just take out the phrase "in that movie," and I think that would apply in general.
I don't know what
he's doing.
I don't want to disparage Quentin Tarantino. It's like the works of Quentin Tarantino are near and dear to so many people. I like a lot of the stuff that he's done too, so.
Yeah, I'm trying to think I just remembered also the movie I was thinking of was called Near Dark, which is
Near Dark.
I recommend Near Dark. That one. It's pretty solid. It's really interesting because they actually never say the word vampire in the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And also Lance Henderson and Bill Paxton are phenomenal in it. But yes, a lot. Like I said, I am obsessed with vampires. I've read, watched so many vampire films, TV series. Obviously, recommend What We Do in the Shadows for anyone looking for recommendations. Byzantium is a really good one. True Blood.
I mean, that was sort of my access point to vampires. I watched True Blood. I watched, I'd say, 2/3 of it because it started to, speaking of Dark Shadows, it was like a Dark Shadows for our time that it got real soapy, but I thought it was a really interesting way. I mean, the way that they represented vampires as a stigmatized, minoritized community was super interesting. You know, the way that, like, they were regarded, especially the fact that it took place in a southern town, you know, the other characters that were of other minorities that populated the town as well, and how they interacted with the vampires. Yeah. Like, it was a clear allegory that I think was interesting at the time. It sucks that it ended up spiraling out into just, like, pure gobbledygook by the last few seasons, but when it started off, like, I would recommend those first few seasons of True Blood to anybody. It's a really... really cool. I mean, if we're talking about a show that is obviously, you know, making statements about today's world, True Blood was one that ironically did that as well a bit in the very beginning, based on, you know, the Sookie Stackhouse novels as well.
Yeah, for sure. Especially with the character of Lafayette, rest in peace, Nelson Ellis. Mm. Loved that character. But I mean, just the way in which Lafayette navigated the world, kind of like being a queer character in the Deep South, but also being willing to be around vampires and, like, you know, realizing, like, the oppressed class, realizing another oppressed class. It was, I don't know, I thought that show was really interesting, and it did get incredibly soap opery, but I was, like, there for the drama of it and, like, the... you know, super attractive people that were a part of the show by that point. So I was more than okay with, like, a weekly dose of that.
Yeah, I would say if anyone just wants to check out, like, an awesome scene talking about Nelson Ellis and Lafayette, just watch the AIDS burger scene from True Blood season one. It's like just a fantastic, piece of work.
Is that like his introductory scene too?
Might I want to say it's like maybe like his second or third episode, because I feel like he was probably like put in for a couple lines in the first episode, but I remember that's like his first big, I mean, that's the moment that keeps him on the show, because spoiler alert, his character gets killed off in the books, and he stayed. But we're sort of getting off the beaten path. We're still on HBO. Let's finish things off here. Kevin, you have any other thoughts you have about the pilot, looking forward to what's to come in episode 2 and episodes to come?
Yeah, I mean, if this is the momentum, especially the momentum we saw as the show picked up and the way it presented literal monsters and figurative ones, I'm super pumped. Like, again, I came in being excited and curious about what they were going to do, and I'm really glad with how the pilot handled a lot of that. Really sets me up for even more excitement as we head further into the series about the way they're going to tackle various topics. Both in terms of horror and both in terms of, like, the way they address race in America and, you know, being a person of color in America and how, you know, the parallels of that in the genre itself. So, yeah, I'm super excited for the show. And it's one of those things where I'm so used to a binging model now. I'm just like, ugh, weekly. What am I doing? This is, I don't have time for this. Like the weeks now feel like 100 years also.
Yeah.
What about you, LaTanya?
I'm excited to have this to look forward to doing every week. For one. Let's see. I am excited to learn more about everyone's backstories, to see some of these smaller characters that we just got tiny introductions to have a bigger impact in upcoming episodes. I'm excited as an audience avatar for Letty to explore more of her thirst for Tick. you know, just because it's there and it occurred and I can understand. I would also like to know what this call to South Korea that Tick made was all about. I wrote down the numbers just because I think I'm conditioned because of Lost to keep track of numbers.
Somewhere Josh's ears are tingling.
Josh
now
felt
too.
It. He felt his spidey signal there. Yeah. So that's the thing. And this is probably the biggest mystery, I think, from this first episode. So the person on the other line is a character who we are going to meet called Jia, who's played by Jamie Chung, who the reality TV loving person in me remembers most fondly from her appearance in The Real World San Diego in 2004. But she's been in a bunch of stuff. But she also plays that red-skinned woman who beams down in the UFO to embrace Tick. So it's very clear that they have some sort of relationship. You know, he does end up calling her and he doesn't even talk to her. She knows who it is and she knows where he is. So I think that speaks towards a certain closeness that the two of them had. But she and Montrose are the only two main characters who have not been introduced at this point, yet it seems like they play the two biggest roles in Tick's life, ironically.
Right. And she tells him that he should not have gone home. So like, what does she know and how does she know it and when does she know it? So where does she know it? So I'm just interested in all of that. Plus, like, I'm fascinated in general by cults. I want to know what is going on in this manner. Not to give anything away from like future previews or anything, but it does seem very cultish. And so I'd like to figure out like what exactly is this birthright that this letter spoke of, and what are these people doing with their possible superpowers and monsters? What are these white people up to? What kind of white nonsense are they up to?
I was just gonna say white people do love starting their cults.
Well, there's actually on HBO there was a preview for a new series about a documentary
the
about
Nexium.
A cult and MLM model that's like very infamous as like a weird like sex organization pyramid scheme thing. So again, not going too far from home here, but I totally agree with you both. I think the pilot set a fantastic table up with its characters, its plotting, its tone, and I cannot wait to eat. And part of my diet is going to be getting to enjoy listening to the two of you talk with Josh. I look forward to listening to you guys every week break this down. I hope you all along for the ride as well. Love to hear your feedback. Again, your own thoughts about the characters, the scenes that maybe resonated with you in particular, the monsters element, the mysteries element, whatever thoughts you have, don't be shy. It's going to be lovecraft@postshowrecaps.com. Again, lovecraft@postshowrecaps.com. Follow all of these lovely folks. Josh is at Round Howard. Kevin is at Kev Mahadeo. LaTanya is at LK Starks. And I am at A Mike Bloom Type. And Postshow Recaps as well, if you want to send out any general inquiries. There's a bunch of other stuff going on as well between Everything is Super, the Lost rewatch. We just started a Aang in there, which is an Avatar The Last Airbender rewatch with Jacob Redman and Zach Muhammad. They just released the first episode. That is a lot of fun. But I want to thank you all for listening, and I especially want to thank LaTanya and Kevin, especially as someone coming in, you know, with an uninformed white POV. I'm really looking forward to getting informed each and every week. So thank you both for correcting me. Thank you both for bringing things to light for me, because like this is the way to learn. This is the way you learn to become an ally. And I'm so excited to see what this show does and what you guys are able to do with this podcast, because it's going to be something really special. That being said, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you all again so much for listening. See you on the next ride. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.